This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful.
Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Iran urges the UN to prevent misuse of Security Council Resolution 2231, saying the ban on Tehran's arms exports expired in 2020. A Palestinian youth is killed and three others are injured in an attack by Israeli forces on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Also ahead, a new report shows inflation in Japan hits its eight-year high in September amid the falling yen and the rising energy prices. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story, Iran says there is no legal ground to link a UN Security Council resolution endorsing the 2015 deal to allegations that Russia uses Iran-made drones in the Ukraine war. Iran's ambassador to the UN, Saeed Iravani, made the remarks in a letter to the Secretary General after Ukrainian officials called on the world body to inspect downed drones in the country. Kiev accuses Tehran of violating UN Resolution 2231 by providing Russia with drones, a charge Tehran vehemently denies. Iravani rejected Kiev's allegations as unfounded and a misrepresentation of the UN resolution. He said an embargo on Iran's arms exports under the resolution expired in October 2020. He also noted that the arms restrictions applied to the transfer of missile technology designed to be capable of carrying nuclear warheads. The diplomats also called on the UN chief not to allow any abuse of the resolution for the sake of the war in Ukraine.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days.
Kiev and some of its Western backers accuse Iran of supplying Russia with Giron-2 drones. Ukraine claims Russia has acquired as many as 2,400 of the UAVs. The West accuses Iran of breaching a UN resolution that placed an arms embargo on Tehran. The embargo expired in 2020 despite Washington's efforts to renew the measure.
The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed-136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. The West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
Tehran says the claims of the Western countries to support Iranian women are not sincere and in good faith, stressing that Iranian women do not need guardians.
Iranian women are smart, well-educated, dedicated, and patriotic and are aware of their rights. They also understand how to engage with the government in a peaceful and constructive manner in order to advance their rights. Therefore, we advise those Western states that they are not required to act as guardians or caretakers of Iranian women or speak on their behalf.
Zahra Irshadi was speaking at a UN Security Council meeting on women, peace and security. She criticized some Western countries for what she called baseless allegations against the Islamic Republic under the pretext of supporting Iranian women. Irshadi denounced those allegations as attempts to politicize women's rights, adding that such claims are in line with double standard approaches toward human rights. She noted that inhumane anti-Iran sanctions by the U.S. have violated the basic rights of Iranian women. Irshadi also pointed to the death of 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini in mid-September, which sparked riots in Iran.
The tragic death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian girl, has broken the hearts of not only our government, but also the people of my country. We regret the incident and hope to never have to witness such a heartbreaking loss again. A thorough investigation was carried out to determine the circumstances that led to this tragic death. So far, the findings of two preliminary investigations have been shared with member states and UN-affiliated organizations.
Irshadi talked about the significant role of women in Iran's various domains. She said more than half of the population of Iranian university students are comprised of females. Irshadi said 73% of Iran's medical specialists are now made up of women. Israeli forces have killed yet another young Palestinian man during a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. The Palestinian victim has been identified as 19-year-old Saleh Bariki, who died after being shot in the neck. Three other Palestinians were also wounded after regime forces stormed the center of Jenin and raided several buildings firing live bullets. Israel has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians across the occupied territories. More than 120 people have been killed in Israeli attacks so far this year. Official data shows the inflation in Japan hit an 8-year high last month amid rising energy costs and the falling value of the yen against the US dollar. The data suggests core consumer prices rose 3% in September, exceeding the 2% target set by the central bank. The figure excludes volatile food prices and mainly includes raw materials. Service prices associated with wages were also not seen meaningful hikes. The slump in the currency to 32-year lows is said to be pushing up import costs. The Bank of Japan has attributed the inflation to exceptional events such as the war in Ukraine and the government's ultra-loose policies designed to encourage sustainable growth. The world's third largest economy is heavily dependent on energy imports and even buys other goods, including much of its food from other countries. Thousands of people in a small Italian coastal town staged a protest against a government's LNG regasification plant project. They fear the plant could endanger public safety and bring detriment to economic activities in the area.
On Wednesday, about 3,000 people took to the streets of west central Italy's town of Piombino to stage a rally against the outgoing government's plan to install a floating regasification terminal in the port. Italy has been struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to unprecedented levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and a new regasification plant is part of a Mario Draghi executive's plan to ease the energy crisis. In an attempt to reduce its dependence on Russian gas, Italy has increased gas supplies from Algeria and opted to expand its regasification capacity. If the government gets the go-ahead on the regasification project, a floating storage unit would be placed in the small port of Piombino.
We are really concerned for the safety of our citizens, as the regasification plant will be placed only a few hundred meters away from homes and offices in a very busy and often rough sea. What if there is an accident or a fire breaks out? Furthermore, tens of tons of sodium hypochlorite will be dispersed at sea. It would be a disaster for tourism and fishing activities.
The floating storage unit would have a 5 billion cubic meter capacity, and according to the government's plan, it would be connected with the country's gas network by the spring of 2023, an event that is very unlikely to happen, according to experts. Italy has an annual consumption of about 75 billion cubic meters of gas. Of this, around 30 billion cubic meters used to come from Russia. People from Piombino have staunchly opposed the project for months, staging more than 30 protests in the span of 5 months.
Young people are struggling for their future, for our beautiful town. The government should have not thought of Piombino in the first place.
The outgoing government has also picked the city of Ravenna as a site for a second regasification plant, with construction works set to start in the first 4 months of 2023. A decision over the project in the port of Piombino could come as soon as Friday. Max Civili, Piombino.
European Union leaders have failed to find immediate practical solutions at their summit called to address an energy crisis fueled by the war in Ukraine. After lengthy talks in Brussels, the leaders failed to impose a price cap on gas to counter halt in supplies from Russia to the bloc. However, they agreed to keep working on a roadmap to contain energy prices for households and businesses. European Council President Charles Michel said the energy crisis represents a threat to the bloc's internal market. He said a maximal coordination was needed to address the issue. Before the summit, Germany refused to back calls for a cap on gas prices, but in a sign of concession, Berlin also agreed to work on mechanisms for containing prices. French President Emmanuel Macron, who had gone into the summit saying Germany was isolating itself, expressed satisfaction with the outcome of the meeting. That wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
Massive protests and strikes of French people against rising living costs was just partly covered in Western media, especially the French news outlets. However, some world media websites reported these demonstrations elaborately. In this regard, we have taken a look at some of the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. NPR reported. Thousands of protesters, including France's newly crowned Nobel Literature laureate, piled into the streets of Paris recently in a show of anger against the bite of rising prices and cranking up pressure on the government of President Emmanuel Macron. The March for Wage Increases and Other Demands was organized by left-wing opponents of Macron and lit the fuse on what promises to be an uncomfortable week for his centrist government. Transport strikes called for Tuesday threatened to dovetail with wage strikes that have already hobbled fuel refineries and depots, sparking chronic gasoline shortages that are fraying nerves among millions of workers and other motorists dependent on their vehicles, with giant lines forming at gas stations. Macron's government is also on the defensive in Parliament, where it lost its majority in legislative elections in June. That is making it much harder for his centrist alliance to implement his domestic agenda against strengthened opponents, and parliamentary discussion of the government's budget plan for next year is proving particularly difficult. In a firebrand speech to the Paris March, far-left leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon charged that Macron is fried and that his leadership is plunging France into chaos. Mélenchon predicted that Macron's ministers would have to ram the budget through Parliament's lower house without giving lawmakers a vote, a controversial prospect that provoked loud boos from the crowd. Organizers claimed that more than 140,000 protesters marched. Paris police said they didn't have an immediate estimate for the size of the dense, flag-waving crowd that filled the squares and streets. There were a few outbreaks of vandalism on the margins, with garbage bins set on fire and bank machines smashed. Riot police kept order. Demonstrating at Mélenchon's side was French author Annie Ernaux, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature this year. Mélenchon, twice beaten by Macron in presidential elections, declared the protest an immense success. Organizers called it a march against the high cost of living and climate inaction. As well as calling for massive investment against the climate crisis, they also demanded emergency measures against high prices, including freezes in the cost of energy, essential goods and rents, and for greater taxation of windfall profits. Lawmaker Christophe Bex of the left-wing party France Insoumise, or France Unbowed, called the march a demonstration of strength to show that another world is finally possible if we are all together and all united. Another marcher, retired railway worker Eric Duarte, said, "What we want is for everyone to live decently with the purchasing power they had before." Also, Tasnim News Agency wrote, the demonstration against the rising cost of living was called by left-wing political opposition and led by the head of the France Unbowed party, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. Al Jazeera reported, it was a show of anger against the bite of rising prices and to crank up the pressure on the government of Macron. Organizers called it a march against the high cost of living and climate inaction. As well as calling for massive investment against the climate crisis, they also demanded emergency measures against high prices, including freezes in the cost of energy, essential goods and rent, and for greater taxation of windfall profits by corporations. Some protesters wore yellow fluorescent vests, the symbol of often violent anti-government protests in 2018. that shook Macron's pro-business centrist government. Opponents of Macron are hoping to build on the momentum created by the refinery standoff that began at the end of September. Transporter strikes called for Tuesday threatened to dovetail with wage strikes that have already hobbled fuel refineries and depots, sparking chronic gasoline and shortages that are fraying nerves among millions of workers and other motorists dependent on their vehicles, with giant lines forming at petrol stations. Organizers said 140,000 people attended the recent rally. Police earlier predicted about 30,000 people would attend. Organizers claimed 140,000 people took part in the recent march, while authorities put the number at 30,000, according to media reports. Public sector workers such as teachers, nuclear workers, and railway workers are also expected to protest in response to calls from French unions. In recent days, the government of French President Emmanuel Macron has been working hard to find a solution to resolve oil refinery strikes in an attempt to return things to normal life. Earlier this week, Macron said the conflict must be resolved soon.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
And so Saudi Arabia finally did it. With its great influence within the OPEC organization, the kingdom pushed, along with Russia, for approving a severe reduction in oil production by no less than 2 million barrels per day. This decision had a shocking impact on the United States, which, since the decision was issued last week, seems to be drowning in a state of hysteria. There are many considerations when explaining the Saudi drift, the most important of which are two reflections. The first is that Mohammed bin Salman wants the U.S. administration to understand that its refusal to recognize him as a full-featured legitimate ruler of Saudi Arabia will not remain without costs, and that he has no deterrent from shifting the electoral balance towards the Republican Party on the eve of midterm elections in the U.S. You can actually hear the Democrats hyperventilating on the verge of their inevitable defeat. The second reflection is that bin Salman has no choice but to stick to the soaring price of oil, hoping to yield more profit to implement his projects that come at a hefty price. In this, Mohammed bin Salman appears at the intersection of very clear interests with Russia, which in turn desperately needs effective weapons in the face of Western efforts to devalue Russia's energy exports and weaken its ability to finance its war against Ukraine. On the other hand, the Biden administration now faces difficult choices after it bet on a Saudi response which quickly proved that these demands do not even rise to the level of wishful thinking. Now, although the U.S. has already begun considering steps to discipline the Saudi rebellion, nothing would probably protect it from the public anger that began to simmer as gas and goods prices took an upward trend in the U.S. market. It is now crystal clear that the Saudi-U.S. relationship as a whole has entered a new era, the most prominent of which is the loss of trust between the two sides, as the U.S. accuses Saudi Arabia of choosing Russia's side. Saudi oil minister Abdulaziz bin Salman, one of the crown prince's brothers who dominate many of the main centers in his regime, denounced these accusations, saying that the goal is to prevent the deterioration of prices in light of talk of a possible global recession. Considering that Saudi Arabia is insulted by U.S. accusations of siding with Russia, since according to the Saudi oil minister, OPEC Plus is not only composed of Russia and Saudi Arabia, but rather includes 13 member countries of OPEC and 10 countries outside it, and these unanimously agreed to adopt this choice. No doubt this Saudi position was not expected by Washington, especially after Biden's recent visit. The OPEC Plus announcement did come at a very sensitive time for the Biden administration and in light of attempts to isolate Russia, which is an important member of the Oil Exporters Alliance. It unexpectedly seems that the strategic alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States of America has indeed come to an end. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. A new chapter of tension came across the relations between Washington and Riyadh after Saudi Arabia adopted the decision of the recent OPEC Plus forum to reduce oil production by 2 million barrels per day, starting from the 1st of November, amid the loud attacks launched by the United States of America against Saudi Arabia, describing the decision to reduce oil production as a political support for Russia and a source of a new burden on global inflation. Now, Saudi Arabia denied these allegations, which it described as emotional statements to influence the U.S. midterm elections. This new rift came in the midst of an energy nightmare that the Western world is experiencing due to the developments of the war in Ukraine and unprecedented European sanctions on the oil sector in Russia. To discuss this issue with us from Washington is Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, former head of the Arab National Conference, political writer and commentator. Thanks a million for being so early with us from Washington, Dr. Hafiz. Now, with the announcement of the decisions of the OPEC Plus summit, we see that U.S. President Joe Biden has a lot of difficult decisions to make, especially when he's trapped in a time game just weeks before the crucial midterm elections for Congress, diverting the attention of the public opinion in the United States towards this new energy crisis. The U.S. is annoyed as it considered this Saudi alignment with Moscow. Are you a bit surprised that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia said no to the United States of America on this very, very crucial matter?
Good morning, Marwa, or good afternoon at your place. No, in fact, I'm not surprised at all. I think it was something that I have called about 4 or 5 years ago already. And I was seeing the evolution of the relationship between the Kingdom and the United States. Even though during the Trump administration, we could detect the signs of frustration within the government of Riyadh about the behavior of the United States. Those who were following very closely these attentions, you could see it, for instance, in certain editorials of Saudi newspapers the frustration seeping. That would not have been possible had not a green light been given to these editorials. So no, I'm not surprised. Secondly, I think it was very clear, especially in the last few years, that the balance of power has been shifting significantly outside the United States and outside the West. And I think the Saudi leadership, as well as many countries in the world, have realized that the United States and the West have no longer anything to offer. So it was almost a natural thing to see that. Now, what has accelerated this rift, as you've called it in your introduction, I think is that the United States, because it's running out of options, has tried to take over the OPEC, and by defining how much production needs to be done, made, and what is the price cap, that was against the laws of the market, as they always try to promote. And the decision that was taken by OPEC Plus is not a decision that was unilateral by the kingdom, but in the aftermath, and this is, I think, people fail to understand, in the aftermath of the summit that took place in Samarkand, which means that there is a new world order now in place, and not is going to take place. It's already in place. And the partners are discussing among themselves what are the decisions. So this is a decision which is a collective one made by the heads of states of the Samarkand attendees.
Well, we have heard several times that this world, a new world order, but this is the first time we actually feel it happening, and we see that the United States of America is in paranoia about this, which is why they are calling, especially the Democrats in the United States of America, they are calling, first of all, to withdraw missile defense systems from Saudi Arabia, and they are demanding to pass a NOPEC bill, which allows the American judiciary to consider punishing oil-producing countries like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia under the claims of monopolizing the strategic commodity of oil and raising its price. Are these empty threats just to scare the Saudis? Because it's not the Saudis that are being threatened here. Or is it just a stage that will pass?
No, I think it is a mixture of both. These are empty threats, and also it underlies a serious rift. But there is a basic contradiction between what the Democrats are proposing and the overall strategy followed by the United States. You cannot unilaterally withdraw a protection umbrella, and still keep your own bases in Saudi Arabia. So it is either a total withdrawal of U.S. forces, not only from Saudi Arabia, but also from the Arabian Peninsula, which would be consistent with what they're trying to do, or it is just an empty threat and a bluster. Second, I don't think that within the deep state in the United States, especially those who are running the foreign policies, like the neocon and the liberal interventionists, they will allow Congress or even the president to go through that kind of decision, because there are too many vested interests in maintaining these things. Lots of money to be made, and of course there is the basic admission of a total defeat and withdrawal from the region, which they are not able or they cannot accept at this stage. So I doubt very much that they will go through, even though that you may have lots of publicity around it.
Well, Dr. Hafez, Riyadh's agreement with Moscow within the OPEC Plus Forum, while ignoring U.S. Pressures to increase oil production, appear as another step on the path of strategic diversions between two historical partners. To further confirm the fact of this rift, the Wall Street Journal quoted U.S. officials as saying that Saudi Arabia hopes for acquiring more American-made guided missiles have almost vanished. Is this really a historic moment of political shift for the Arabian Peninsula, or is it merely a shift only as long as the Biden administration is there? I mean, if the Biden administration changes, will Saudi Arabia just reassess and then start over with its alliance, strategic alliance with the United States of America?
I've been asked this question several times, and I think it's a little bit of both. It could be at the time being that the lack of chemistry, so to speak, between the President Biden and the Crown Prince has fostered this kind of acceleration of the rift. It could be. And there are people who are betting that if the Republicans come back to power, and especially if President Trump gets back to the White House, that things will go better. I don't think so, because the rift, as I've already said it earlier, has started even within the presidency of Trump, when the United States was unable to defend the oil facilities in Saudi Arabia against the attacks of the Houthis. And also when it was unable to prevent, to assure security of oil tankers in the Gulf. And of course, unable to help or to defend the United Arab Emirates. So you can see already the signs that the Americans were not in a position or not willing to do the defense. So the whole strategy was based on an exchange, security against oil. Now, if security cannot be provided by the United States, then the foundation of that kind of situation is no longer there. This is the basic premise. Now, between now and next, and the next 2 years, things may be created on the ground that will either consolidate this divergence between the United States and the kingdom, or it will, jeopardize this new tendency. I think that the diplomacy followed by the Russians and the Chinese and even by the Iranians is very well tuned and very well coordinated, and they are doing their utmost to draw into their orbit many Arab countries. Look what they have done with Turkey. They've managed to neutralize, to speak, Turkey, mm-hmm. and making clear to Turkey that its interest is in the East and no longer in the West. So this thing can also happen with the kingdom. And mm-hmm. I think this is a trend that we're going to observe.
Well, and it is going on at a fast pace. We are literally watching in a show the New World Order being formed. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, former head of the Arab National Conference and political writer and commentator, for joining us to talk about this very crucial matter for West Asia specifically. Thank you. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be discussing how Iraq got out of its political stalemate.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Iraq completed the presidential elections and reopened the political process without considerable problems, despite the bombing, which is the message that targeted the Green Zone prior to the election session. This message was immediately denounced by the Sadrist movement in what seemed to be a proactive response to whomever would think to accuse the Sadrists for it. In the midst of this, the Sadrists, which chose to leave the political process in Iraq, finds itself alone with almost no options but to wait for the failure of the new government and pressure towards holding early elections, but without threatening the country's security, hopefully, which seems to be everyone's concern in Iraq and the region. Iraq ends political stalemate in the following report.
After three failed attempts, the Iraqi parliament finally succeeded in electing a president, who in turn appointed Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani as prime minister, in a move that is considered to lead the country out of a severe political crisis. Since the Iraqi legislative elections on October 10, 2021, the influential political parties in Baghdad, despite numerous negotiations, have not been able to agree on the name of a new president of the republic and the appointment of a new prime minister. At the heart of the crisis were the two major camps, the coordinating framework on the one hand and the Sadrist movement on the other hand. This led the Iraqi street to become tense, and matters even reached bloody confrontations, after which Muqtada Sadr announced his withdrawal from parliament, then his and his party's retirement from political work entirely. An option that worked in benefit for the coordination framework, making them the largest political bloc in parliament. And so the Iraqi parliament succeeded in electing Abdul Latif Rashid as president, a largely ceremonial position reserved for the Kurdish minority. In turn, the latter commissioned Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani to form a new government. A Sudani now, as required by the constitution, has 30 days to form a government. The biggest factor in the success of reaching this stage politically was the openness of Faleh al-Fayyad, head of the National Contract Coalition, and Ahmed al-Asadi, head of the National As-Sanad bloc, to the rest of their partners in the country, and their formation within the coordination framework and with the Sovereignty Alliance and the Kurdistan Democratic Union Party, the State Administration Alliance, which agreed on the names of president and prime minister. Meanwhile, despite its retirement, the Sadr movement in Iraq announced its refusal to participate in any future government, condemning the assignment of Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani to form a government led by the coordinating framework. Muqtada Sadr's spokesperson, known as Assad's minister, Saleh Muhammad al-Iraqi, said in a statement, "In the midst of forming a coalition government of militia subordination that has not and will not meet the aspirations of the people, we deplore and denounce the suppression of the people's voice refusing to return Iraq to square one." The nomination of As-Sudanis by the coordination framework a few months back was a spark that ignited tension between the framework and the Sadrist movement, whose supporters staged a sit-in in front of parliament for about a month. Muqtada Sadr proved his ability to destabilize the political scene by mobilizing tens of thousands of his supporters to take to the streets. Hence, it is not wrong to say that As-Sudani's task will be a difficult one, and that the road ahead of him will not be paved and planted with roses, as there are multiple agendas brewing in Iraq, on top of which is the Sadr disapproval of anything related to the new prime minister.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, who is a journalist at the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar. Thank you very much for being with us, Hamza. Now, the Iraqi political forces, through the election of Abdul Latif Rashid as president of the republic, ended a year-long political deadlock since the legislative elections that were held in October 2021. Where is the Sadrist movement from this new political phase in Iraq?
Thank you for having me on your show, Marwa. Leader of the Sadr movement, Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr, took the decision himself to remove himself and his party from the Iraqi political scene. Of course, this decision came after a long string of events, consequences and developments, which in the end led to seemingly place Sadr in a losing position in the recent political events in Iraq. Naming PM Mohammad Shia al-Sudani specifically were basis for the political decision of retirement that was taken by Sayyid Sadr. If we go back to immediately after the legislative elections in Iraq in October 2021, up until our day, today, we see that a lot of events have developed on the Iraqi scene. Namely, what we witnessed from violence on the streets of Iraqi cities, which resulted in scores of deaths and injuries among Iraqi youth. At the end of the day, the main demand of Sadr out of these street escalations were unrealistic, as he demanded the resignation of several prominent figures from within the coordination framework. Obviously, these demands never saw the light of day, as it was nearly impossible to ask for the removal of political figures from Iraq's political scene simply because they have different views than that of Sadr when it comes to practicing politics. Add to that the continuous rhetoric and threats of resorting to violence, which basically isolated the Sadrist movement even further. This was evident by the Sadr supporters who took to the streets to wreak havoc, to raid public institutions, the country's parliament and presidential palace. All these steps that eventually led to resorting to armed clashes proved that won't open any way for the demands of Sadr to be met. Add to that the recent Russian-Ukrainian war, or rather, the US-Russian war on Ukraine soil, which urged the US to work towards finding peaceful political solutions in oil-exporting countries like Iraq, Yemen, and even in the US pressure against Zionist Israel to accept the Lebanese demands when it comes to the maritime border demarcation negotiations. All these regional developments led to Sadr finding himself left alone, with no local Iraqi political cover, nor a regional one. Not even from Saudi Arabia or the UAE, and neither from the US Embassy in Iraq, which was positive towards electing a new Iraqi president and prime minister. So was the opinion of the UN and other foreign embassies in Iraq. Hence, all these developments surpassed Sayyid Sadr's ambitions and demands. Rather, these demands became a burden towards finding peace and political security inside Iraq. This also led to ending the political stalemate in Iraq without having the Sadr movement on board.
But
something happened during the parliament session while electing a president for Iraq. The Green Zone was hit by 9 Katyusha rockets, wounding 10 security forces. Who do you think would benefit from such violence at such a timing? I mean, what kind of a message are these perpetrators trying to send to Iraq?
In the past year, the Green Zone in Iraq has been dealt with like a mailbox, where opposing parties in Iraq tend to communicate through using rockets and gunfire instead of actual dialogue. Last week, one of the scenarios would suggest that launching 9 rockets during the parliament session to elect a president in Iraq was perceived by many Iraq observers as a message that reflects that there are people who do not benefit from electing a new president and naming a new PM in Iraq. The message was simple. Whomever launched these rockets decided not to remain on the sidelines as the political stalemate in Iraq was nearing an end. What was noticeable was that the Sadr movement was the first party to denounce the attack, which insinuates that the leadership of the Sadrist movement is truthful when it comes to preserving the security in the country. However, as it is well known inside Iraq that the Sadrist movement has several arms that are spread out of the span of control of the set of Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr. There exist several sub-parties within the Sadrist movement itself that might have planned and executed on its own, away from the approval of the Sadr movement leadership. There is also another scenario that implies that one of the many foreign intelligence apparatuses operating inside Iraq would benefit from inciting chaos, might be actually behind these attacks. However, that electoral day ended with electing a new president and naming a new prime minister.
Yes, as you said, the coordination framework made sure that Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani would be named as prime minister, but al-Sadr was not happy because we all heard the statement coming from his minister stating that Sadr considers the framework as liars and deceivers and that Sayyid Muqtada can never agree with them. Is that an indication for a possible new political deadlock in Iraq?
The position of Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr is open and crystal clear. He has not changed his position yet when it comes to naming Mohammad Shia al-Sudani as prime minister. Especially that the choice of al-Sudani by the coordination framework was the main reason for the Sadr movement protests and sit-ins 2 months ago, which resulted in the death of 50 people. The choice of al-Sudani again announced a defeat to al-Sadr and his political stances. However, the developments following the electoral process, which are fully supported by Iraqi parties who want to see a political solution in Iraq, it was evident that Muqtada al-Sadr will play the role of the opposition towards al-Sudani's government to be whether in the streets or on parliament. Mind you, Sadr had already withdrew all his representatives from parliament and he still refuses to be part of any political solution or to have ministers named on his movement's behalf or at least names allies to his movement. All these suggestions so far are being turned down by Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr, yet refusing or accepting any of the proposed political solutions to get Sadr back on board the Iraqi political scene will reflect the discourse which Sadr will choose to take when it comes to the soon-to-be-appointed Iraqi government. Sadr bets that he can mobilize the streets again as a weapon to bring down any appointed government and push for early parliamentary elections.
That's to see actually people going back to the streets, which might get things out of control, but we hope that it doesn't. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist at the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar, for joining us to discuss this issue. And I want to thank you, ladies and gents, for being with us and following through what we are bringing to you every week. We'll see you again next week with new topics.
in the limelight.
A team in Colorado has developed a two-step process that uses chemistry and then biology to break down a mix of the most common plastics that make it into recycling plants. Stay with us for an exclusive article in this regard published in Nature. Mixtures of plastics, usually a headache to recycle, have been broken down into useful smaller chemical ingredients in a two-step process, reported in Science on October 13th. The plastics problem facing the planet is exacerbated by the difficulty of recycling these robust materials. Although chemical methods exist to chop up their long polymer chains, these techniques have been difficult to implement at scale, partly because recycling needs to deal with mixtures of plastics. A team led by Greg Beckham, a chemical engineer at the U.S. National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL, in Golden, Colorado, has developed a two-step process that uses chemistry and then biology to break down a mix of the most common plastics that make it into recycling plants. High-density polyethylene, a soft plastic often found in food packaging, polystyrene, which includes styrofoam, and polyethylene terephthalate, a strong, lightweight plastic used to make drink bottles. Ning Yan, a chemist at the National University of Singapore, and one of the few researchers to have developed a system capable of that, said, "Only a few works have reported chemical recycling of plastic mixtures before. Combining chemical and biological pathways to convert plastic mixture is even more rare."